podcast about the monster spooks and nasty guys that inhabit your favorite fantasy settings. We're your hosts.
Hi, I'm Noel, and I hope you don't find this episode in poor taste.
Hi, I'm Colin, and I'm looking forward to Santa's claws and beak.
And today we're talking about mushroom men, owlbears, and the scalehorn blight.
Put on your stockings and mushroom cap because we're going stool-tied caroling.
But first, some news and updates.
This is the coming day on Christmas Eve.
Merry Christmas!
And it's also the first night of Hanukkah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So yeah, happy Yule.
We think you'll enjoy it. Our gift to you, I guess?
Yeah. I guess our gift to you all, dear listeners, is, we're doing two format ideas that we haven't done before. Yeah.
You know, sometimes we give good gifts, sometimes we give bad ones. We hope this is a good one.
Yeah. So today we're going to be covering the Mushroom Men Glens. We're going to be debuting, normally when we talk about monsters, we're talking about sentient monsters.
Usually, yeah.
Occasionally we are going to detail the history of, run-of-the-mill, beastie monsters.
All right, I like that.
Yeah, so we'll be going over owlbears. And then we'll also be covering our first historical event, the Scalehorn Blight.
Sounds unpleasant.
Oh, yes, and stinky.
Ooh, boy. All right, that's my kind of thing.
Yeah. But yeah, without further ado, mushroom men.
More on mushroom men.
Yeah. So, what part of the world do the mushroom men occupy?
The mushroom men actually inhabit the eastern part of the continent. Southeastern, really.
Yeah.
Directly, in and adjacent to the eastern mountains, below the Fey Courts, but above the southern jungles. They occupy a sort of middle zone there. Not very much in contact with much of anyone, really.
Yeah, they're kind of, they're in a small little spot. They're kind of isolated.
Right. And honestly, that's usually for the best. But we'll cover that later.
Yes. just to give, a frame of reference for things we've already covered, just to the northwest of the mountain range that they're kind of butted up against is the good old Dryder jungle. And just to the south of them is the big old jungle that that green dragon, those kobolds hate, hangs out in.
Yeah.
Yeah,
honestly, it sounds like they live in fairly hostile territory.
Yes.
it's a wonder they're still there.
Well, it just seems like, the green dragon isn't going to go around fucking with them.
It's not his digs.
Yeah, there's probably dryders in up in those mountains at certain points, but they're not gonna go over that because the kind of area it is heavily forested,
mm-hmm, of course.
But it's not necessarily jungle,
right?
And as you pretty much know that you're in the mushroom folk area when, you start noticing that everything's covered in lichen.
and not the kind that shifts under the moon. Just plant lichen.
Yeah. That's probably, contributes to their isolation is, every once in a while there's probably roves of explorers and traders and whatever have you, just trying to find out, what's in this area. Is this, it seems pretty peaceful. Is there, a trade route we can exploit through here or something?
Right.
When they bed down to sleep for the night, they usually don't wake up.
Yeah. I honestly, when you have mushroom roots suddenly sprouting up into you.
Yeah.
That's not something one wakes up from. Ow.
Or if you do wake up from it, you're a very changed person.
Very.
And that's not to say that, the mushroom folk are malicious about it.
Certainly
it's just
not.
Kind of,
it's in their nature.
Yeah, there's a living, creeping carpet that they just, they
right.
keep healthy because
right.
it's a part of their ecosystem.
It is, and it's a thing that keeps them healthy as well.
Yeah.
Just the mycelium carpet that keeps all of them together.
Yeah.
It's almost akin to if one's played StarCraft, the creep.
Yes.
It's just something that they have to keep healthy to keep themselves healthy.
I kind of think it kind of what comes off as equal parts Zerg creep and equal parts the James Cameron Avatar, that whole thing with the entire planet being linked and alive.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, given that one tremendous mushroom in, what, Kentucky, Tennessee? I don't remember, but it literally takes up miles and miles and miles, and it's all one organism.
Yeah.
It's like that, but with more individuality.
Yeah. And I certainly, you know, the individual mushroom folk themselves are technically separated from it, but I'm sure they commune with it frequently.
Consistently, almost to the point where it's a sort of genius loci.
Yeah.
It gives them a fair amount of information and a fair amount of nourishment, and it just is their world.
Yeah. And so because of this, probably, you know, to the explorers that somehow figure out a way to not get, you know, just engulfed by fungus simply by traveling through, it probably seems very, very well manicured.
Yes.
Because, you know, the underbrush is mostly taken up and decomposed by lichen and small fungus and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the trees are in well manicured orchards.
Yes.
Because, you know, that's the major kind of food crop going around.
Right.
And they are kind of, corralled and arranged and knocked down by the mushroom folk's major domesticated animal.
Right.
Owlbears.
Owlbears. What are Wait a second. We're not at that
we're,
point
we're
yet.
Not at, we're not at that point yet.
All right.
But owlbears are well known for being, if a little temperamental, domesticatable.
Yeah.
And when you throw, you know, various brain spores in there.
Certainly. You get some cordyceps there. Hey, you know, they're suddenly a little more amenable.
Yeah.
Maybe not a lot, because owlbears are still pretty aggressive.
Yeah.
However.
And I'm sure they've developed particular blends of cordyceps that don't just, you know, burst their brains open and make them go crazy, but, you know, it's, you know, a light fungus that, you know, isn't, it doesn't, you know, it's still, you know, the immune system still kind of takes it down a peg.
Just popping open a can of cordyceps light.
Yeah. for the stalwart adventurer that has faced a lot of owlbears, the ones in this area are probably, you know, noted for the fungus giving their feathers particularly strange colorations.
Quite so. Because owlbears are traditionally, what, white and brown?
Yeah.
Mostly brown?
Yeah. Probably have a lot of orange, a lot of reds and purples.
Oh,
definitely. A lot of brilliant blues, too.
Ooh, a beautiful, beautiful blue. Oh, I really like that. You get your, like, sparkle owlbears.
Yeah. But the mushroom folk mostly use them to knock down trees, transport trees, replant trees.
Trees.
Yeah, they've got big old claws and they know how to use them.
I mean, they're basically like living backhoes.
Yeah.
Honestly. Like, just imagine owning an owlbear and using it to help you garden.
Yeah.
That's really neat. Just so you get this big old scoop of dirt, and it's like, I couldn't do that with four shovels.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I've always liked mushroom men, but this incarnation, I really respect them.
Yeah. And given that the mushroom, like, even with the you know, ubiquitous creeping lichen everywhere, they pretty much, they stick to small communities. So probably, you know, they don't even... They just leave the owlbears to go out and range for food on their own for what, you know, wildlife does manage to survive on a day-to-day basis.
Right, because there are things that are immune to cordyceps and, you know, even mushrooms and everything. Cordyceps actually is interesting because it's a parasite that has parasites.
Yeah.
Whose parasites also have parasites. And that's the only reason it's not as crazy as it could be.
It's parasites all the way down.
It is, and it's terrifying. It's if I remember the numbers correctly, it's something to the tune of 97% of cordyceps spores are infertile because of the parasites, the paraparasites.
I also imagine there's a major river that runs down from the mountains through the mushroom folk territory and into the Green Dragon's jungle.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that probably a lot of the feed that they use for the owlbears is probably fish from that river.
Oh, definitely. Especially given that both owls and bears tend to like fish.
Yeah.
Mushroom fish. Fish shrooms.
Do you think that they might even purposely infect migrating, salmon, that sturgeons, those kinds of fish, to make sure that they always return that far upriver every year?
I think they may have at one point, until it just became, instinct.
Yeah.
That's really good.
So they've got a bunch of owl bears that they use for heavy lifting. So they really don't need axes or anything like that. So they're not digging up metals or anything like that.
No. The entire area beneath their mycelium is just, even if it were rich with ore, no one would know it.
Yeah.
It's just a thing that's there and that they have no real need for.
Yeah.
It might occasionally enrich the soil in a certain area, but that's it.
What do their shelters look like, though? Because I do imagine that they do, like, in the heat of the summer, they do need some kind of shelter so they don't dry out.
Absolutely. A sort of cobblestone mixture, things, large rocks put together and held together by an agar made of a sort of moss and lichen and just assorted sticky stuff.
Yeah.
Things that they can encourage to grow into the stone and to hold it together.
Big chunks of like sod and peat and whatever.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's
It probably smelled great.
Honestly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what doesn't smell like strongly of the sod and that their own natural incense would just be clean.
Yeah.
Just given all the plant material and all the fungal material around them, with a few exceptions which we'll cover later.
Between these communities, do you think that they maybe, certain communities have orchards of different trees, and that's the majority of trade back and forth is just, the oak mushroom folk trading their oak down to the birch mushroom folk so they have a little bit of variety in what they eat?
Oh, absolutely. That would have to be a thing. And especially with the fruiting trees, because they would provide such different nutrients, such different arrangements and tastes.
Yeah.
That would, just like in any other society, be a big trade material, is different fruits.
Yeah.
Because, again, like I said, different tastes. Things would get bland after a while.
Yeah.
Eventually, you want to throw in a whole bushel of apples with your decomposing oaks, and it alters it subtly and pleasantly.
Yeah. And, mashing it up and putting it in some kind of earthenware pot. And making, a rough kombucha or a miso paste kind of thing, just letting the natural molds and yeasts and what have you change the nutritional compounds to create, vitamins that you don't get out of certain other things.
Exactly. And that would be a thing that they would have had to have figured out quite some time ago, is that, hey, if we need this, and some of our people are getting sick from not having this, we need to make this.
Yeah.
Kind of like the old scurvy. Back in the sailing days.
Yeah.
Just, they had no idea what was causing it. It was just a thing.
Yeah.
And then they figured out, oh, hey, this dude likes to eat limes and he's never gotten scurvy.
Yeah.
Maybe we should try that. Yeah. This is terrible, but I'm doing it.
The kind of thing where it's like, oh, why are we getting sick? Well, maybe it's because we're only bringing beef jerky and Mountain Dew on our voyages.
That can't be it. Turns out it is. Surprise. It's like that sort of thing. That sort of development.
And while pretty much all of these, mushroom folk communities are probably still vaguely aware and in touch with each other just through the blanket knowledge of the lichen, they probably have an entire, subset of a village bard that will take all of, maybe their month's worth of experiences,
mm-hmm.
and then head off to a nearby village in order to just exchange thoughts and on a little bit of a deeper level that you wouldn't be able to do, just reading the kind of plant ether.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Someone who acts as a vessel for the important thoughts and for the events and goings on and just travels around and just... This happened in this month of this time, and this is from here, and then moves on to the next area.
Yeah.
It's just a thing that gets consistently passed along. And it's that would be honestly integral in how they develop and how they've maintained a closeness and a lack of intercultural I guess, warfare.
Yeah.
A lack of antagonism.
Yeah.
It's since they're so close and since they share so well and since they lack the boundaries of written and spoken word and communication, it's just, it brings them together as a closer culture.
Yeah. It would take some kind of cataclysm to really, really make them compete over resources for there to be anything more than, well, really any conflict at all.
Right. Absolutely. And any conflict from the outside world with any of the Mushroom Folk might not arouse the ire of all of them, but it would certainly be something that everyone would respond to. It would just be, and I hate throwing it back to Tolkien, but it would be a little bit like the Entmoot.
Yeah.
It's slow, just sort of, well, we should do something.
I feel like the fact that they are so, so interconnected, probably, you know, if one of the northernmost villages gets, you know, burnt out or something, you know, they'll definitely regret and mourn it, but it's not going to be seen as such a huge loss as, you know, a village that loses maybe even a single person to a raid.
Right, exactly. It's partially because of their in-touchness with each other and really with death.
Yeah.
But I would imagine also partially because some of those mushrooms will continue on through the spores that have been dispersed.
Yeah.
There will always be some remnant of at least some of the of their old villagers, their old friends.
Yeah.
Whereas with, you know, humans or any other thing, it's just, you know, they died. That's it. Maybe they've got kids.
Yeah.
That's it.
I would like to think that every once in a while, you know, a community decides to try and send a mushroom out into the world to go find a community that they don't have, you know, a direct connection with and see if there's others like them out there, or just see what other people are out there, since they probably very, very infrequently meet anyone from the outside world.
Right. Very true.
And I feel like they'd be a really cool character concept is playing, you know, some kind of, you know, mushroom bard or like a weird mushroom cleric of some sort.
Absolutely. I love it. Yeah. I love that idea. Or, you know, a mushroom paladin of some kind.
Yeah.
Just imagine a mushroom in hard bark armor. Just like, instead of like heavy plate mail, heavy plate metal, just heavy plate bark. Ironwood bark.
Yeah. Oh, like almost kind of like a paladin take on a druid.
Yes, exactly. I also imagine that might end up in a sort of dark side. Like, do you remember the that one, the robot who traveled all of Canada?
Yes.
Do you remember how when it came down to America, it was destroyed very quickly?
Yes.
Yes. I imagine like that.
Oh, man. Just a sweet, young, naive shroom just coming into, you know, what, the orcs just to the north of them. And making it about, you know, about through some gits real quickly before, you know, eventually just an orc just smashes it with a hammer.
Yep. Or heaven forbid the Fey Quartz. It accidentally sells the rights to all of its spores.
Yeah. Half the time, just people think it's furniture.
Yep. I mean, it is a toadstool.
Yes.
I mean, in a realm so literal as the Fey Kingdom, who can really fault them?
But yeah, that's, you know, nice little Leviathan locale, the Mushroom Glen.
The Mushroom Men of the Mushroom Glen.
But yeah, next up for a new segment from an entry from our bestiary, we have Owlbears.
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 Who? I'm sorry, the joke is so good I did it twice. So, Owlbears. What are owlbears?
Well, they're owls and they're bears.
All right, move on to the next segment.
Yeah. Basically, an owlbear is if you took a big owl body,
mm-hmm.
And you replaced its front claws with talons. Like, it still has paws, but the paws have talons instead of just regular claws. And then you also covered the majority of its body in feathers, including, you know, very large, thick wings on as a part of its front, you know, legs and claws.
All right.
Also, it has an owl head with a giant beak.
All right. Can it fly? I hope it can't fly.
They can. They're not considered strong flyers. But kind of the what's supposed to be terrifying about an owlbear is, you know, just like owl feathers, they're almost completely silent in flight. So basically they just get on kind of a higher place, pick out some prey, glide a short distance completely silently to drop in on it, and then eat it.
These things came from Australia, didn't they?
No, they came from a wizard.
Australia, right?
An Australian wizard, yes. They are of a class of creatures called monstrosities. Basically, they are things that technically could fall under the nominer of being a beast, you know, like a crocodile or a bear or an owl.
Sounds a bit like a chimera, really.
Yes, chimeras also fall under it. It's basically anything that's just, you know, explain for why does this weird creature exist? Well, a wizard made it at some point, and then it got loose.
Wizards with no sense of right and wrong.
Yes. Why should a wizard have a sense of right or wrong?
When it has the ability to do whatever they want.
Yeah. But yeah, going back to the origin of owlbears, owlbears are one of the few iconic D&D monsters that are not considered intellectual property.
That's important.
And this is despite the fact that this is a Gary Gygax creation. It did not exist before him, and it did after him.
All right.
It's one of the many monsters that he made for Chainmail and D&D. Well, it's one of the many monsters he made for D&D, inspired by cheap plastic Hong Kong toys that he used for chainmail games. He had some little plastic toy from China that he picked up somewhere that was like, you know, an owlbear. It's the Bulettes are the same thing. Some kind of four-legged shark toy that he had. He also used that, became the Bulette.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And it's, you know, been in literally every single edition of D&D.
As it should be.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of, honestly, the most genius monsters out there.
Yeah.
From a monster enthusiast, this is brilliant.
And I couldn't tell you why it's not considered part of intellectual property.
Probably because they couldn't get the copyright for owls or bears.
Maybe.
Give it 10 years.
I guess the things they really focused on for that were things that they had like more story driven stuff associated with.
Yeah. For some reason, I just can't see them actually getting the rights to an owl plus a bear. I mean, they probably could, but it just doesn't seem right.
Yeah. Well, and like the other thing is, like, even more a weird point, rust monsters aren't licensed.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
I think. Let me double check that.
That's ridiculous.
Because Bulettes aren't licensed either. Like, I could see the idea of not being able to license the idea of a land shark, but the Bulette name specifically, I'm very, very surprised is not, you know, trademarked.
Well, thinking about it, all three of them are known, but none of them are iconic, except for the owlbear.
I would say Bulettes are almost iconic.
I don't know.
Rust monsters are definitely super iconic, and yes, they are definitely not licensed.
All right.
and that is a monster that was literally made just to fuck people up in role-playing games.
Yeah.
But we digress.
Yes.
Owlbears. Owlbears. Yeah, owlbears have shown up in literally every single edition.
Rust monster, owlbear, Bulette.
A rust bear. A rust owl.
A rusty bear, Bulette. It can dig, fly, and destroy your armor.
Just the best. It can, oh my god, it'd be able to dig through solid rock or solid metal.
Yeah.
Be able to dig through metal ores, be able to dig through metal doors.
It'd be unstoppable.
Could dig through your armor.
Why has no wizard done this yet?
Because even wizards have fucking ethics. They don't have morals, but they do have ethics.
And that's just against all ethical codes, I suppose. Not even the demon world would do that.
Owlbears have gotten some different iterations. You know, you've got your winter claw owl bears, your arctic owl bears, your fire breathing owl bears.
Your what?
Yeah, so owl bears are, of course, you know, very, very heavily featured in OSR stuff.
All right.
Whether or not you think that that means old school revival or old school rules or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever you think that acronym stands for. They are heavily featured in that. And in at least one OSR style game, they have a fire-breathing owlbear.
Why?
Because wizards. It's in Basic Fantasy. Basic Fantasy has a fire-breathing owlbear, and you know, if you're a wizard and you're like, oh, I'm going to take an owl and I'm going to combine it with a bear, and you're sitting around, you're thinking, you know what else this needs? Fireball. Because wizards love fireball.
That's not right. Why? God. That's not right.
Owlbears also appeared in Warcraft.
Yeah. This is true.
They're called officially in the first Warcraft 3 game, they're called Owlbears.
Mm-hmm.
But in every subsequent expansion in all of the various lore books that have come out since then, World of Warcraft, the role-playing game, etc., they are referred to as Wildkin. And they're a little more sentient. You can have a Wildkin form as a druid.
Moonkin!
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I remember them.
Yeah, basically, you take an owlbear and you also throw antlers on it for some reason.
Right, and put it on two legs.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that. I actually played the druid. For the short month that I played WoW, I played a druid, and I had a Moonkin form.
Yeah.
It was cool.
I want to say it was a druid guide written by a guy named Pancake or something, but it's the best WoW druid guide in the world, and it will tell you that Moonkin no good for Moonfair spam.
All right.
Oh, no, wait. Cat Durid, no good for Moonfair spam, but Moonkin Durid, good for Moonfair spam.
Yes. That's important.
Yes.
Everyone listening, remember that. This will be on the test.
Yes. Owlbears, if you want to play an enlightened owlbear, Moonfire spells, apparently, they're going to be really good at.
All right. So, like, we've covered what they're used for. We've covered what some of them can do. Breathing fire. How'd they domesticate them?
I mean, just how you domesticate anything else. Like, I guess a big thing, they're probably territorial.
Mm-hmm.
So, ironically, if you interact and treat them how you would treat a cat, you know, because they aren't
right.
they're solitary to a degree,
yeah.
But you know, like bears and owls, they do rear young. They do occasionally live in communities.
All right.
Or I guess colony would be the proper term.
Yeah.
So you know, they're not entirely unsocial, and if you let it know who the food comes from, then yes, you can definitely use it as a guard animal.
All right, that's fair.
And probably, owls are pretty smart. You make an owl the size of a bear, it's going to be really smart. You're going to be able to train it to do stuff.
All right. I can get that.
They're made by wizards, so they're probably like, hey, you know what I really want this abomination to be? Smart.
That's very fair. I get that. Both very and very unintelligent.
Yeah. I mean, just imagine you're just hanging out in your wizard tower, going about your day. You're trying to, write stuff down on your manuscript scrolls and whatever. And then just without you even being able to hear it, you just get just tackled by your owlbear that swoops down from the rafters because you're paying attention to something that's not it, and it just wants to sit on top of you and cuddle with you.
Dear God.
And so it puts you in its owlbear hug and then just lightly just nibbles at you with its beak.
How did wizards survive to keep going? How did wizards not just kill themselves just through dumb?
I mean, owlbears are cute.
Owlbears are very cute. However, I don't want... Okay, no, that's... I was about to speak a falsehood. I was about to say I don't want my giant cuddle monster to have, like, 10-inch claws, and I was like, you know what? I actually do. So.
I mean...
I get it.
You know, it If you endear yourself to your owlbear pet, I'm sure that it will know when to use its claws and when not to use its claws.
Yeah. And it was in that moment that Nolbard finally understood wizards.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen the videos of people cuddling with bears, right?
Yes. Oh, so good. Those giant floppy lift hug beasts.
They could only, kill and eat your entire body.
You know what? Honestly, most of the best animals are that way.
So yeah, owlbears.
That's owlbears.
Owlbears.
Owlbears are really neat.
Yeah.
And also really scary. They're like the only thing scarier than drop bears.
I mean, oh man, and they're such a great, I don't know, like old school RPG like monster.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, you know, it's not like, Umber Hulks or something, where it's just kind of like, oh, well, it's big, and it's kind of insectoid, and it's got pinchers, and it wants to eat you.
Yeah.
And it's not like, Beholders, where it's this weird floating eyeball with a mouth and other eyeballs coming off of it, and they know magic, and you can talk to them, and this is their weird fucking deal, and it's inspired by a Jack Vance novel or something.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, yeah, a wizard made an owlbear. It's an owlbear.
it's an owlbear. It communicates exactly what it is with its name. It's an owlbear.
It's dangerous. It's frightening and intimidating. It lets you know you're in a fantasy setting.
Yep.
But it's not too crazy.
Exactly. Just enough to put you on guard a little bit, but not enough to just send you reeling.
Yeah.
I like it. It's a good basic monster.
Yeah. And that leads us to our other new segment, Monster Memoirs, which will account various historical events in Tau'zerk.
Mm-hmm.
And this time we'll be talking about the Scalehorn Blight.
Ooh, that sounds bad. The Scalehorn Blight. So what's that?
Normally in the part of the world that the mushroom folk live,
mm-hmm.
There is the kind of prevailing wind comes inland and pushes their spores back up into the mountains. And they kind of, instead of drifting off into other lands, they kind of get pushed up and trapped and then just come back down in their general vicinity. So
makes sense.
The highest concentration of spores are up in the mountains, which is where you're going to find most of the mushroom folk.
All right.
If there's a slight change in the wind, say that there's a particularly warm or cold year, certain environmental, or, if fucking a green dragon pulls off some weird, stupid, magical bullshit, or whatever, the lich before he becomes a lich and he's some kind of terrible wizard king casts some grand elemental spell, who knows, whatever.
Whatever it is, it screws up the weather.
Sometimes weather gets screwed up, and then, winds can get reversed, and suddenly all of these mushroom spores are being blown down over a huge jungle. And down into a marshy swamp, where a bunch of lizard folk live.
That just sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. So out of the jungle, mildly affected. It's a jungle. It's got a lot of competing organisms that can, feed off of mushrooms and stuff.
Right.
So even though, it definitely spread a lot through there, it was never that huge of a deal.
Certainly.
But out of the jungle, just comes this creeping, fungal menace. And the lizard folk don't know what to do with it at all.
Right. that's something that they've never quite encountered.
Yeah.
They know that there's weirdness up north. They know that that's a thing.
Yeah.
They've never had to really, really come to terms with it, though. So when, not quite a shambling mass, but more like a stealthily creeping mass of just stinky, gelatinous mushrooms.
Yes.
Just sort of makes its way onto your territorial land. How do you deal with that?
I mean, at first they probably didn't even notice it.
Yeah.
And just kind of as it kind of crept down, it probably, maybe first they started noticing that, their food tasted off, that some of their crops were kind of a little blighted, their food stores, more often than not were spoiling that.
Certainly.
Kind of thing.
But Eventually,
when, you know, your marshes and Everglades and your mangrove clusters are being completely taken over by the stinkiest mushrooms you can possibly imagine.
When every step releases a fine mist of stank.
Yeah. And when your tribesmen or tribesfolk are starting to be covered in, you know, horny, black, leathery looking masses coming out of them. When usually if a lizard person gets horns, they're, you know, at least smooth and coming out of the right places of their body.
Certainly. They don't interfere with average everyday movement.
Yeah. Sometimes when that happens, things get a little extreme.
A little extreme, huh? So by a little extreme, are we talking, you know, we're going to abandon the place and we're just going to run away? Or...
Well, I think... They're probably going to try and clear it out first. You know, lizard folk, they're stubborn. They don't want to lose their land.
No, certainly. That's theirs. They've lived there for generations and generations and a generation's worth of generations.
Yeah. But, I mean, these are the same lizard folk that are making crescent steel.
Yes.
And that normally, anything weird and crazy that stumbles out of that forest because, you know, green dragons probably, you know, making owlbears, making various chimeras, abominations, you know, what have you. Crescent steel's pretty quick to deal with it.
Right. It's a strong force.
Not in the case of these mushrooms. It's just like any other hacking implement.
It's completely natural.
Yeah.
There's nothing supernatural about this. They're just mushroom folk.
Which just makes it seem even more supernatural, probably.
Right.
Like this is God descending on our lands and you know, poisoning us.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what it is, because I imagine that any sort of hostile fungal force is going to bring about changes like, you know, ergot or or like cordyceps.
Yeah.
Just nasty, nasty stuff. The kind of things you don't want in your food stores. You don't want your kids around. That's like raising your kids in a house made of asbestos.
Yes. And by the time that the lizard folk realized what the source of everything was and what was going on, it was so deeply rooted that, yeah, they aren't going to abandon their marsh, but they are going to drain and burn probably a good thick swath of it right outside the jungle where all of the stuff is kind of wafting out of.
Absolutely. Scorched earth, burn it, salt the earth.
Yeah.
Just leave a no man's land. Just something, just absolutely dead earth where nothing can grow. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
They just cleared it, destroyed all the buildings, drained the marsh, magically drained the marsh, cut down all brush, all scrub, all trees, and just ruined it.
Yeah.
Just as a precaution. They probably could have been more careful about it, but no. No, 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 no. That's not what you do.
Yeah. I mean, this is down to, you know, in generation sense, mummification and salting dead bodies has become commonplace to help preserve them and keep them from being taken over by this ghost of this blight that swept over their land.
Quite so. Even though it only happened, you know, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
It's still, they probably killed it off. That's left up for the future.
Yeah.
But it's such a terrifying, terrifying concept.
Yeah.
Something that even if, you know, the current generation of lizard folk don't remember it happening,
yeah,
they know the stories. Even if they don't know the stories, they know how to fight it.
Yeah. So, and just anytime any new plant starts to sprout up that they didn't plant themselves, we've got to keep an eye on it, got to figure out what it is before it gets too big.
Exactly. So much so in the vein of this paranoia that it's led to a unique sort of guard that patrol the sort of no man's land. A diverse cast, a diverse group of lizard folk, taking from all tribes south of that area. It's a border guard that, you know, usually you'd think with a border guard you'd have heavy armor, heavy weapons, that sort of thing. This isn't for fighting people off. This is a sort of horticultural border guard.
Yes.
This is a fungicidal, a omnifungicidal border guard. Traditionally being equipped with a belt with several satchels and several pouches, all filled with things useful in eliminating plant and fungal life. For instance, a belt filled with flasks of oil, on which they may pour things and then light. A pouch filled with salt for just sprinkling on anything. Pure water on which to spread the salt with. Armed traditionally with long-range weaponry, bows, just in case. Long spears for anything that, you know, looks like a mushroom but then gets up and walks at you.
Yeah.
They don't want to be anywhere near those spores. Just, if they can eliminate something, all the better. Possibly, you know, learning weather working magic, their shamanism helping them work with the spirits of fire or whatnot. Anything they can possibly do. At this point, even considering demonic aid just for the pure ability of their supernatural fire.
Yeah.
Warlocks, I'd say, would probably be heavily liked here. Warlocks, sorcerers. Wild magic would be helpful.
Yeah.
Also, maybe not.
They also, you know, consist, you know, their kind of trail rations, as it would be, are mostly made from kelp. Because if you didn't know, kelp is often fed to cattle as an antifungal agent because it has antifungal properties.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so do a lot of oils. Like, you know, tea tree oil is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Rosemary oil.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's cool. Am I correct in remembering that that silver also has a fungicidal effect? Or is that just purely bacterial?
That's just bacterial.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And probably when, you know, these guards return back to their villages from, you know, a stint up north, they're probably, like, maybe the most comforting thing for them is the burning of incense just to help relax them and set them at ease of just smelling something burning helps them, you know, put to rest the idea of the some kind of creeping, growing menace that could be nearby.
Right. Because it's not uncommon for something to actually sprout up there, despite the salting of the earth. Because fungus is strong.
Yes.
So it's not just a ghost presence, a ghost fear. This is an actual, very real presence.
Yeah.
However, that doesn't make it any... or, well, that actually aids in making it just that much more terrifying.
So yeah, that's the Mushroom Glen. Owlbears. And the Scalehorn Blight.
Scalehorn Blight scare you.
Yes. Yeah, but hey, I hope everyone is enjoying their holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you celebrate, you know, even if you know, if you're just in school, you know, at least you have a break right now.
Yeah.
And please just think of all the people who might listen to this that have to work retail right now.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
At least it's over now. As of you probably listening to this episode, the retail season is done.
And honestly, retail workers, we salute you. You have to deal with the real monsters.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
The creatures without culture.
Exactly. So please, think of your fallen retail brothers.
Yeah. And hey, hopefully maybe you got some dice this year.
Oh, yeah,
that'd be cool. Or someone bought you maybe an RPG supplement you've been have your eye on. Or yep. Maybe you're just sitting down and reading, I don't know, some kind of crazy fantasy book.
Whatever it is, enjoy it.
Yeah.
Take inspiration from it. Remember, it's that kind of thing that births this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you know what? Honestly, I encourage you to start this sort of thing. Talk about what you like. Talk about it with your family. They might like it too.
Yeah. Who knows?
Talk about it with your friends. Not strangers, though. That's weird.
I just, how many people do I know that are like, oh, you know, I want to play a goblin or a kobold, but I don't want to bring it up my group because they'll probably think it's weird. But like 9 times out of 10, that's not the case.
Most of the time, they're just like, all right.
Yeah. But yeah, as always, you can, you know, if you want to rate and or review us on iTunes, you can do that. That's a thing you can do.
That should be really helpful.
Yeah, make that your Christmas gift to us.
That'd be really nice. But it's up to you.
Yeah, we would always appreciate it. You know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it helps us. Helps us help you.
Yeah.
Because we've gotten a little feedback. We've been able to help some people.
Yeah.
And that's great. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And we'd just like to be able to share some with some more folks.
Yeah. So yeah, and as always, you can always ask questions to us on creatureculture.tumblr.com/ask. Mm-hmm. You can always find us on Twitter,
yep.
Gmail, whatever.
Yep. Just, Nolbard at everything.
Yeah, Pagetish at everything.
And I'm always willing to speak with you. Always cool. I love talking with you folks. Like, I've gotten some messages from some folks asking about it, and it's just makes my day. So please, just, we love hearing from y'all.
Yeah.
And hope you have a safe and happy holiday season.
Yeah. What are we going to go on? Do you think owlbears can smell truffles?
Yes.
Oh my God. Could you imagine if a bunch of werebores came down and just like discovered this poor mushroom glen? It might be the only thing that could actually put a dent in them.
Yeah. That'd be terrifying.
Oh man. Just that's an adventure scene in a nutshell. Finding out that there is a crusade of werebores.
I like that part. That's terrifying.
It's a little off the wall. I don't know. It's nice.
I mean, it has a solid foundation.
Yeah.
And it makes more sense than the ravenous werebores. Because that's always a thing. Absolutely no reason.
Yeah.
They're there purely for storage.
Well, they're there because they're being used as a super racist Mongol XP. But that's another conversation.
Yeah. In universe, there's no reason. But with werebores, they're actually assholes.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that
a
lot.
And they love truffles.
God, yes.
Man. Oh, now I just miss the truffle butter from work. Or, Yard House's stupidly expensive but very, very good truffle oil French fries.
What?
They have French fries that they fry in truffle oil there. And they are the best.